Hello and welcome to the Plasticology Project podcast, conversations about plastic pollution and stories from inspiring people trying to make the planet cleaner. My name is Dr. Paul Harvey and I am the host and author of the Plasticology Project book. Thanks for joining me. As I was moving through the production phase of this podcast, I started to think about words that I put in the back of the Plasticology Project book. Those words are, as the species on the planet that holds itself in the highest esteem and by many accounts is the most intelligent species, we do very well at being ignorant of the warning signs of impending danger. Humans are being presented the clearest of warning signs that our planet is in peril, and yet we still go to great lengths turn away and ignore those warnings. As you listen to this podcast today, I'd like you to think about those words. Think about the enormity of the task that is being discussed. And ask yourself, are we really hearing the warnings? Are we really responding to those signs? Or are we turning a blind eye and hoping that the problem will simply go away? On this episode of the Plasticology Project podcast, I speak with Matumba Faisal. Matumba is based in Uganda on the shores of the mighty Lake Victoria. Lake Victoria is the largest lake in Africa, the world's largest tropical lake, and the world's second largest freshwater lake by area. The lake supports a fishing industry that helps feed a population of around 40 million. Matumba has taken on the enormous task of trying to repair the degraded environment of Lake Victoria and create a better future for this environmental asset. Matumba spends his days leading the Uganda Junior Rangers, travelling to some of the 985 islands of Lake Victoria, collecting discarded fishing nets, ghost gear and plastics. Matumba's mission is to educate the next generation of Ugandans and encourage them to love the environment. I caught up with Matumba just after he stepped off a boat, returning from a morning trying to resolve one of the other great challenges of the lake, invasive weeds. We join the conversation just as Matumba explains to me how these invasive weeds are impacting the lake and how plastic is a part of this story.
So invasive cleanup initially wasn't our goal, but what happens to the weed, it floats through the plastics.
Okay.
So it's plastics hide between the weeds. Or sometimes when it comes, it covers the plastics that it finds on the different shores. So there's that blanket cover, so it makes it hard for it to you to recover the plastics. Oh, once it is covered with a weed, it's a big struggle. So there is a program by the Egyptian government to evacuate this weed, but this is something they do ideally like once a month, a year. So in many months they do once a year. So we came here with the leadership, the Egyptian people, talk to them, see how we can get involved with them to make it regular, to clean up the water weed, so we can actually reuse, because what they do now is just clear and dump. So, and this is fuel, because they're dumping. So we had a meeting with them today. Tell them that we can try and make it regular, and when we recover, we use it for biomass or biogas energy. Then we can create some employment and save some trees by transforming this weed into energy.
What sort of weed is it?
Water hyacinth.
Yes, I'm familiar. Yeah. That's really interesting. I've never heard that you can actually turn that into biofuel. But, this is something that's new to me.
Yeah, it produces a lot of energy. You can do a lot of things with it. It's a very good fuel.
That's so interesting. And so that the water hyacinth is just growing everywhere, I presume, all over the lake, is that right?
In some water bays, it is there. In the high waters, it's not there because of the waves. It pushes it in the bays. So in the bays, the huge problem in the bays, and it suffocates the fish because it cuts them off oxygen, and the habitats that it invades, all the fish die out. And these problems of keeping the plastics in there, when you do your recovery on the lake, then it's a huge problem because you have to remove it and find your way between the weed to pick up what you have to get from there. But yet it's a fuel that you can use, create employment, save a few trees by converting, turning it into energy.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. I like that. That's such a great way to turn what is a problem into a solution, really. I think that's really cool. So let's take a step back, I think. Tell me about the plastic pollution that's led you to the water hyacinth issue and the biofuel.
It started out I had interaction of moving out to the beaches. All of a sudden we get connected with this fishing community then. And you could hear the frustrations about the industry, fish stock issues, going out on the lake and come back empty-handed. And then the distance they have to move increased, distances they have to move to look for fish. So I got curious to look into what is happening. Then we realized problems of plastics and fishing gear is a problem. Disposal is a huge problem. There is no infrastructure for waste management on land and in the lake. There is a bit on land, private, but most of these communities are poor. They cannot pay for these private waste management services. So what happened is they keep they're wasting the houses in the night or in their shops. So when night darkness falls, then they go dump it wherever they can. So ideally, fishing communities, their ideal dumping site is in the lakes. We step out to try and find these problems. We try to put in place infrastructures, recycling bins, then we try to recover what is out there already. The problem is huge because logistics, the boats, and some high places you cannot reach because the boat we have is small. It's not safe because of the waves. So you try and keep in the shallow locations or islands that are close to the shallow to the landings. So that's where we go out. Then currently what we do is to collect and store. You often, whatever space you find, you often run out in a few weeks. So it fills up so fast. Yet you take a lot to the dump site. So, and what we try to keep is what is a bit clean. Majority is ancient. Most of it is legacy plastic. So it's so dirty, and the recycling company say we don't take, we would take it. We have cleaning machines, but the cost of running these machines on electricity is so expensive, and we don't have subsidies. So if government gave us subsidies and the fuel and electricity cost wasn't high, we have cleaning. Some recycling companies have bought cleaning machines and they are not running, so they can save on the costs of managing their factories. So now what they do, they only take clean plastics. So a lot is collected that is dirty and ends up in the landfills.
The plastic material, is that the ghost nets and the fishing gear and plastic bottles and containers and packages, or is it just the packages with these recycling facilities?
It's all we collect across, because now other plastics, there's a bit of demand for other plastics, like hard plastics. So then PET is a problem. Few people are recycling, but speaking up. Fishing gear, no one has done before, and there wasn't collection. So solution was to ban. So we aggressively going out to look for fishing gear, legacy, discarded and dumped. Or try to collect before it is discarded. We encourage putting up food soldiers or volunteers in different places. We talk to the port owners to bring the fishing gear to us. So collecting still facility we found is filled to the brim already with fishing with the fishing nets. And this is demand for it is huge in Europe. We're looking at recycling it here, but demand is already huge. There are a lot of companies in France, Netherlands, who are shrouding it, then producing other things, socks, T-shirts, bags out of this in fishing nets. But the reach is a problem now because the demand is huge. So we often go to a lot of places and you find fire dying out of, and they tell you we had almost a ton of plastic of these old nets and we burnt. So we say, oh, next time, please don't do that. Just call us. We'll find a way of coming and picking it up. So we give them a little something for their time and their work. So, and we give them some money for these waste bins so they can collect and put in these waste bins. So then we go and pick it up. But it's over 100 islands on Lake Victoria. We can only reach like maybe 7 or 8. So you can imagine the rest of island and landing sites are over 100, close to 150 different landings. So the whole solution waste management is to ban in all these islands. So what we collect, it's possibility if we spread out our tentacles recovery, it's possible to, I can guarantee it's possible to recover over 5 tons daily of all fishing nets. So the huge that is discarded, because none has tried to recover before us. And there are thousands of fishermen who depend on this lake, and they all dispose of cuts or throw away something every day.
That's a phenomenal amount of material that you're pulling out, and thinking that it's a lake system. It's not going to go anywhere. If you weren't there removing it, it would continue to build up, right?
Yes, it doesn't go anywhere. And yet Europe has been leading, because this is raw material for many factories. So it's not waste as it is today. So once it is recovered, you can find market in Europe, or we are looking at putting up an infrastructure here. Then we start converting it and recycling, upscaling it into productive items. We're looking at disability assistive technology. Access to assistive technology here is almost 85, 98% who needs assistive technology. People faced with disabilities and need assistive technology, they don't have access to it because of the cost. So we're thinking of converting it and produce assistive technology, then make it accessible to these people with disabilities. So these are dreams we have. But right now, all we are doing is collecting. So this is a bit of how we got into this and where we are now.
Yeah, that's a journey and a half. And it sounds like you've made a huge impact already with the work that you've been doing. I mean, 5 tons per day easily of net material out of the water. That's phenomenal.
Yes, but because that's potential, but now we are collecting, because of the capacity we have so far, only collected 2 tons. Because because that's what I can afford to, because they need money to move on their legs. They need fuel to fuel their boats. So far, we've only made 2 tons. That is what is within our means. But potentially, you can collect over 5 tons. That is a day. So, that is different funding organizations with a lot of resources, the poor and two governments. Government buy cars that cost $100. With $100, we can collect tons of it, but because they trust the government, they don't trust you, so they cannot give you the resources. Because they ask for already resources you use to run your services, whatever you try to do, community outreach, education awareness, and collection you do, they want to use it, then you pay accountants, auditors, and stuff like that. So government is, a lot of resources are floating around, but they end up in the wrong arms. Government is already has a lot of money to fix these problems. The current government has been in power 40 years. Problem is getting worse. And the different funders keep pushing these millions of euros and dollars and Deutsche Marks to the same government. So this is a situation, it's frustrating, but we know slowly, hopefully we, through collaborations and partnerships and trying to put out the word, we know maybe some people, someone out there will join hands and find solutions to this.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have a chat with you. It's because I've seen the work that you've been doing and I've heard about the work that you've been doing from some other colleagues in the plastic pollution space. And I hope that maybe somebody listening to this might just be that right person that hears your call and is able to help you. That's my hope.
Yeah. You know. Yes, we hope, because what is interesting, this is a raw material that is in demand for factories in Europe. So there's that missing link of just food soldiers to collect, package, and send to Europe. Then you close the circular loop, and you provide jobs, you save, you protect, you save marine habitat from further destructions. Then directly supports fish regeneration because these pollutants are killing the fish. They are so destructive to fishing habitats. Fishing stocks are dwindling, so a lot of lives depend on these lakes and the other water bodies. So they're at stake. People living in poverty, girls are driven into prostitution because their parents cannot take care of them anymore, so they have to find ways of surviving. And yet this small solution of collecting and shipping or producing and upscaling here can create jobs, save all different value down the value chain, can save a lot of livelihoods. So I'm glad to connect with you, and hopefully we are hopeful, we haven't lost hope. We are in this in the long run, so hopefully someone will step in and we can join hands and fix things.
So you go under Junior Rangers. What's that all about? Is that part of this plastic pollution cleanup process, or is that a separate entity?
So it's a process. It's under the nonprofit Junior Rangers that we run these activities, and we initially had also ideas of, because we, it's assessment of failure of systems and adults who have caused these problems and are failing to fix it. So under Junior Rangers, we approach is to try and educate the children about this, engage them into fun ways, outdoor activities. We try to encourage them, introducing them to environment through conservation fishing, then try to make the process exciting. Then we open their eyes or their understanding to the issues that are happening to the environment and explaining to them that we cannot have this fishing anymore if everything is distracted. So idea is to build that love from infancy. So when they grow up, hopefully with more love and understanding, and they get into positions of power, so they can better protect these natural resources. So that's why I approached, we named it Uganda Junior Rangers also, because our focus of education and awareness. And we have dreams. We know if we build these children with more love for these natural resources, they can protect them better than us today.
That's terrific. And you've absolutely hit the nail on the head by saying the children of today will be the leaders of tomorrow, essentially. And if you can educate them today about the choices they make and the importance of a clean, productive environment, then hopefully the future is looking a little bit brighter. Plus, you have a great group of people there helping you out, removing the nets and doing all the others.
I'm so excited, and you get problems of disappointment. Now, what I have, I'm the problem now, because I get calls from different islands. People tell me I've collected this amount of weights. Can you come and pick it up, please? You promised whatever we collect, you come and pick it up. Then I have to tell them, give me a week or two. I have to find the resources to power, to fuel the boats. Then I'll get to you and I collect. Just be patient, keep it aside. You send them some little resources just to not discourage them, because already I'm disappointed you haven't collected on time. So it's pain, and these calls keep coming in. They keep increasing, and I'm happy to receive them. But I know after some time, hopefully I'll be able to go wherever a call comes from, and I pick up this waste in time.
So give me an idea then of what is required in terms of resources for you to go out and do what you do on a daily basis.
Because basically it's a boat and fueling it. Because I have volunteers who are willing to go out without taking anything from me. I convince them, once we do this, a time will come when I'll give you everything you need. But sometimes I offer them T-shirts, and they are happy to go out and collect, just receiving a new T-shirt and they wear. So major obstacle is a boat and fueling it.
How many boats do you have in the fleet? Do you just have one boat?
We use one boat. I have to lease it. I have to rent it every time I go out with it. And I have to fuel it. So that cost you have to incur to go out. You have to pay for the boat. You have to pay for the fuel. So these are costs that are involved now. So if I can cut out at least the boat cost, which is sometimes more expensive than the fuel to the islands I have to go to. So it's a huge cost.
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine. And it wouldn't be a small boat either. It would be something large enough for you to be able to move the material safely.
Yeah, most of the time it's overflowing. And we when we talk about boats, we don't talk about fancy boats. We talk about just a hull, the hull and the boat engine. So basically what we saw ideal boat, it's in a cost of around $5,500. That's the kind of boat we need. We don't need $1 million boats to do what we do. So right now we have to rent a wooden boat. And the last time we were out, some places are rocky, so we were cleaning up some rocky place. We got a few hits. Right now it's being fixed. It's completed fixing and painting is done also. So we'll be on the water back again. But now these repairs you have to do every after 4 or 5 months. because we use wood and the quality of craftsmanship is not the best. So often you have leakages of water flowing in, and the collusion is a big problem. So often you have to do repairs and repainting. So more cost every time. Then after repair and repainting, you have to pay for the boat and you have to fuel the boat again. So these recurring costs are a huge hindrance on how many islands you can reach and how many locations on the lake you can go to.
Yeah, the ongoing costs are sounding like they're quite prohibitive, actually, stopping you from getting out there and doing more of the great work that you're doing, getting to more islands and getting to more areas and cleaning up more of the nets. Walk me through a day in your life when you're going out to do the cleanups, from wake up in the morning, heading out to coming home at night. Walk me through that.
It's always exciting days because staff and the volunteers are always looking out to that day. So every day you fix a date of going out, so you have a lot of excitement, and early in the morning you start receiving calls like 6 a.m. So now what time are you getting to the spot we have to meet up? So often now, sometimes because you need some decent rest, so I keep my phone in silence till about 8 o'clock. Then I start returning their calls. I tell them where we have to meet. Then we get to the spot. Then get into the t-shirts, then get on the boats. So to keep them excited and happy, we always play loud music. They enjoy it so much. So then head up to the waters, and they're always so excited. The ride, they enjoy the ride so much, and reaching different spots and islands. Often you have new people who have not been on the boat, and those that have not been on the islands. And then when you get their experience, they're shocked by the amount of plastics they see on the islands. Because many of them have not been there, they don't expect it to be on the islands. So when they see the amount of plastics, a lot of them are shocked to see the different islands have a lot of plastics floating around them. So there's that shock when they get there. Then when we start getting that, everyone is happy to pick up as much as they want. Usually we'll do it for 3 or 4 hours to avoid the sunburn and stuff like that. But often they don't want to leave. So they say, oh, still so much, can we continue at least for a few minutes, then we'll pick up. So you have to, there's another fight of getting them off the island. Oh, guys, now this is time to wind up. We cannot finish everything today. We shall come back another time. Then it's like, well, then you start getting questions, when will the another time be? But then, because sometimes the resources, you're not sure of when you're going to return into a different island, then you have to convince them. I'll let you know as soon as I know exact date. I'll give you a call. It's like, you promise. Will you promise you call me back? I want to come. I'm enjoying this. So to you, some people might see it as work, but it is fun for a lot of people I go out with. They enjoy the experience of going out on the water and the islands and picking up the plastics. So ideally, that is the experience. Then we go, I have recycled bags I take with me. So we fill these recycled bags, then return them, come back with them, take a few pictures with them. They're excited to, especially the men are not so excited about the picture part. Women love it so much. So they do a lot of their tricks and posing and smiling with the plastics and the waste. So they enjoy the picture so much. Then we have a yard. So when we recover and then we have to sort what is too dirty and what is a bit clean. So then the dirty we have to pay, I have to get a truck, pay for the cost of taking to the dump site. Then what is fairly clean, we rented out a yard, collection yard. So then I have to take that to the yard. So basically that is what happens.
And then from that yard, a buyer will take that material, is that right? From there?
So we because we run out of space, now we are going through those phases of trying to dispose of the plastic bottles and other items to the buyers. But the ghost nets that we recover, that we are looking aggressively of transforming it and basically closing the circular loop, creating a circular loop of transforming it and create see our goal, my goal, experiences, because I've worked with people with disabilities, I know challenge they have to access assistive technology equipment. And when they do, it's often donations of wheelchairs and other equipment from the first world, Europe, Australia. So this is all equipment that people pick up, ship in a container and distribute. So what happens to the equipment, it's good thing what they do, but because it is non-designed to suit the recipients, so it causes a lot of secondary injuries. So I've seen some people who have 6 wheelchairs or 5 wheelchairs donated to them, but they don't use them because each of them has caused them wounds and more suffering. So they'd rather crawl on the ground than get more wounds and injuries. So seeing all these experiences, these people, it's hard to stay clean when you don't have legs and you don't have equipment to help you move around. So these people have to crawl. Nature of the sanitary facilities here is most of them are pit latrines or bath places that are outside. So people you have to crawl to use sanitary facilities. So you can imagine their hands and their feet. So hygiene is a huge problem. So this is the life they live. Many of these problems cause shortening their lives and stuff like that. So because we are looking at trying to create this industry through upscaling some of this material that we collect, try and provide equipment that is suited to the recipient. So work with the recipient, understand what they need, and take measurements, then make something that will not cause them wounds or secondary injuries. So these experiences is what led to see if we can try and build this industry and try to increase access to these diagnostics and assistive technologies to these people.
Listening to you talk is just incredible. I can hear the compassion in your voice, the empathy in your voice, and the desire to really make a change and to really help people. Is that something that has been with you your entire life, or is this something that's new and it's come to you as you're sort of moving through this journey with the plastic and environmental pollution?
Some traveled experiences growing up. I don't know. The lack of intervention, basically, you needed help and it wasn't there. So you want to be there for others.
Yeah, that's really powerful. It's so incredible to hear what you're doing and just your desire to help. Is there anybody that you're currently working with to try and achieve these goals, or are you doing it all by yourself?
I have a group of people and two organized, one as One Ocean Environmental Organization based in Germany. stepped in to support some activities. Then Ocean Conservancy out of Washington, D.C. has a Coast Gear Initiative program, extended some support. And now we are doing research, understanding the problem, then identify the hotspots, and then research into, do more research into material, fishing gear material that we find, then explore ways of see how we can turn into assistive technologies. So these two organizations have been helpful. So hopefully, we're still hopeful, very hopeful. And the team is hopeful, and the volunteers are hopeful.
That's what you need. You need the hope to start with, and the drive, and the compassion, and the rest will follow. And I hope.
Yes, true. And all that we have already, is I have people come give us a hand without taking any pay home, use their time. They get their hands dirty and they don't need anything from us.
We've already spoken a little bit about, I guess, your vision for the future. And we've spoken a bit about what you need to get there. What would be your number one big, you know, if you could have anything in this mission, what would that one thing be?
I think the biggest obstacle now is, ideally, it's the boat. Logistic is a problem, because different islands, we've met people, talk to them, because it's work for them collecting and burning. To other people, it might look like it is a solution, but people burning these things are not happy, because they have to go hustle collecting and putting these things on fire. And some that you talk to don't understand the overall implication, the impact they have on the ozone layer, then climate change, and overall social cost of climate change. So if you take them through that journey, it makes sense to them. And I see it directly has an impact on their income and their capacity to take care of their families. So when you open their eyes, many people are willing to step in and do something. And they say, if we had a solution, we'll stop doing this. But now that we've met you, we'll collect and queue for you. We'll take your number and call you when we have a lot of it. So it's painful to promise and it disappoints, because we tell them collect, we'll come and pick up. But lack of capacity to fulfill your promise of going and pick up this thing is disappointing. I've had someone send me a message and says, please don't stop wasting our time. Stop telling us what you cannot do. And it's painful to get that kind of message when someone has taken their time to collect and then you don't have resources that day or that week to go back to them and pick up what they have collected for you at no cost. So these are experiences. You go to different challenges and obstacles, and you have to give them time to cool down, then call them in the following day, explain to them your situation. Then many understand and they say, okay, we understand. We'll keep it for you. Whenever you come, you'll find it. Maybe you will even find more. So understanding how to respond to their frustrations and disappointments is part of what we have to do.
There's a very real risk in that, though, isn't there, that you will lose that engagement. You will lose them as a net collector or a plastic collector, and you won't be able to bring them back to the mission. So that's a challenge.
The experiences we had, when you talk to them and explaining them, they understand. Because often they understand after some time. So we give them a day of cooling off, often call them back after one day, apologize, explain to them your capacities, and they're often understanding.
If people are wanting to get involved or help you out, what's the best way that they can do that? Is there a can they connect with you on LinkedIn or other another social media platform?
We are Instagram, we're there. We can connect LinkedIn. We're active on LinkedIn as well, and through also through our partners. I think if someone is finds one at One Ocean close to them, or Ghost Gear Initiative under the Ocean Conservancy, I mean, if they have our contacts, but it's a Google search, and our cannot go a day or two without reaching out or responding or replying to any email that comes in. So social media, Instagram, Uganda Junior Rangers, then Instagram, then LinkedIn, Mutumba Faisal. We can connect. And yeah. I'm happy to have some people come in, visit Uganda. Hopefully you can come as well. Then we can go out on these cruises and do some cleanups. It's a good experience.
One day I would love to.
Many provide a shock in the beginning what they see, but activity and it becomes fun and exciting for them. Because I guarantee almost every new people I take out, I have to drag them back on the mainland. They don't want to leave the islands.
Well, Mutumba, thank you so much for having a chat with me. I will let you go because I know that you do have a lot to get on with today. It's been absolute pleasure talking with you and hearing about your journey. And as I've said before, I think you're doing incredible, amazing work, and I wish you all the best for everything in the future. And I hope that those big dreams of yours come true.
Thank you so much. Honor to connect with you, Ali.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Plasticology Project podcast. It's been great having you along. If you'd like more information, please see the show notes. Alternatively, head to www.docpjharvey.com. If you have been enjoying the Plasticology Project podcast, please make sure to subscribe on whatever platform you listen to your podcast. Please also head over to the website and join the mailing list to stay up to date with the latest happenings in the world of the Plasticology Project. This has been another episode of the Plasticology Project podcast. Thanks for listening.